Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, October 20th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from DePaul Housing Management, managing communities for seniors throughout the Capital District, on-site staff and campus-like settings, depaulhousing.com for information and photos. Today we welcome Dr. Smadar Bogardis from Troy Surgical Associates, a practice of St. Peter's Health Partners Medical Associates. Dr. Bogardis specializes in general surgery with a focus on robotic surgery and complex laparoscopy. Laparoscopy is the actual term. I added an extra syllable. Gallbladder pathology, colon pathology, hiatal hernias. We're off to a flying start. The number to call is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Medical Monday after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Medical Monday, and today we welcome Dr. Smadar Bogardis from Troy Surgical Associates, a practice of St. Peter's Health Partners Medical Associates. Dr. Bogardis specializes in general surgery with a focus on robotic surgery and complex laparoscopy. I've said it a billion times. I can't get it right today. And whatever. You know what? She'll say it. Gallbladder pathology, colon pathology, hiatal hernias. She received her medical degree from the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston. She completed her general surgery residency at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, received her bachelor's from Texas A&M. If you have a question for Dr. Bogardis today, give us a call, 800-348-2551. Maybe you'd like to just call in and say laparoscopy. You can do it if you wish, 800-348-2551. You can also email voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Smadar Bogardis, welcome. Did I get your name right?
Smadar Bogardis, yep.
Thanks for having me. So, what's your favorite type of surgery?
I love all sorts of general surgery. I mean, that's part of why I became a general surgeon. We call it bread and butter surgery. But me particularly, I have a soft spot for hiatal hernia repairs and for colectomies, taking out part of someone's colon.
All right, before we get to the colon, explain in simple terms for a radio person to understand, what's a hiatal hernia?
A hiatal hernia is basically where your stomach creeps up into your chest. So where it's supposed to be.
So when we go to, get an endoscopy, that's where you find out if you have one of those?
Yeah, or sometimes it's caught on a CT or an ultrasound or something.
And how do you fix it?
You pull it right back into the belly where it's supposed to be and basically tighten up where that gap where it slides up into the chest.
Now, when you came into getting your degree, your medical degree and everything else, robotic surgery was already well advanced. How often do you actually use the old knife and get going?
Pretty often. I would say anytime there's an emergency surgery, we still, make a big incision to just move faster to, if it's critical in somebody's life.
Why is that faster?
Because although robotics gives us a much closer up view and gives us, really fine techniques, if something's bleeding or we don't know what the problem is, it's faster to just make a big incision so you have access with your hands physically.
When you do robotic surgery, does that require pre-programming of the device or is it just basically intuitive and an extension of your hands?
It's definitely an extension of my hands. I mean, it's not autonomous. I often have patients say, oh, so the robot's going to do the whole surgery. And I laugh a little bit because, of course, it's not. It's not making any decisions. There are presets, to the machine itself. And then for the most part, it's just a tool in my hands.
So we've had plenty of general surgeons on this program in the past. But I don't know if I've ever asked, what is general surgery and what don't you do?
Yeah, 20, 30, 50 years ago, that answer would have been a lot different than today. General surgery as a specialty encompasses almost everything, from breast to skin cancer to colon cancer. Anything in the belly really is fair game for us, hernias, gallbladder, liver, all those things. And then over the years, people have become more specialized. So I would say that I personally, there are definitely things I don't feel comfortable doing just because there are whole fellowships where you learn how to do, Whipples and complex.
So Whipple being of the pancreas, right?
Right.
And you say that one of your expertise areas is colectomy. So you're cutting out a piece of the colon.
Right.
And how has that, how has technology changed what you do?
So, I mean, I'm lucky, like you said, when I was in medical school, robotics was already burgeoning. It was already out there. So I started using the robot pretty early on. I mean, basically the minute I got into clinical work. But I think colon surgery is one of those places where the robot or even laparoscopy is key, because instead of making that big incision to get out the colon, which is a fairly large organ, we can make all those small incisions, use fine instruments, do all the work, and then, you know, make only one smaller but large incision to get it out.
Now, I assume this reduces the length of time a patient stays post-op. Does it help outcomes in general?
Definitely. I mean, it's been proven that minimally invasive surgery, which encompasses both robotics and laparoscopy, decreases hospital stays, decreases pain, decreases, you know, how long of a recovery it is for the patient, how much narcotics they need to use for recovery, and, yeah, gets them out of the hospital faster or prevents them from having to be in the hospital to begin with.
We're joined today by Dr. Smadar Bogardas of Troy Surgical Associates, a practice of St. Peter's Health Partners. The number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Bogardas is a general surgeon with a focus on robotic surgery. It's 800-348-2551. You can also email your question to voxpop@wamc.org. Are any, you don't have to name names, but you can if you want. Are any of the older surgeons totally not happening with robotic surgery?
Oh, definitely.
All right, I mean, let's hear who they are. Who are they?
Without naming names, I mean, it's definitely a learning curve. Even the people who I considered my mentors did not learn how to use robotics in their training. They all learned it post-training. So you have to really buy into it as an older or more experienced surgeon. You have to be committed to going through training courses and trial and error and being uncomfortable, which often, you know, surgeons, we like to stay in our patterns.
We all do. We like to stay in our easy comfort zone. What is it that makes, when you're learning that field, that specialty, why is it uncomfortable? What about it is just seems odd?
You know, it just, there are things you would think would translate because the robot gives you a much better articulation. You know, instead of instruments that can only move up and down, side to side, it simulates how our own fingers and how our own hands work. So you would think that that translation would work a lot better. But oftentimes, you know, sewing is a lot different. You have to think about the angles a lot differently. And then setting up your case is totally different. You know, if you're used to putting incisions in certain places and you have to change it so that the robot can work more efficiently, then that requires a whole mindset change.
And of course, this is, when we say robotic, you're still doing that work. Is there any aspect of, say, suturing or anything else that can be done autonomously? Say, okay, robot, sew it up.
In the general surgery world, I know those things are being developed, but at the moment, the only thing that is really quote-unquote autonomous is stapling, which is true.
Well, I can do that.
Exactly. But even the staplers we use in open surgery are, you know, in that sense, autonomous. You push a button and they fire.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551. Let's grab an email or two before we get to our first break with Dr. Smadar Bogardas of Troy Surgical Associates. This email from Paul. Three questions, basic questions, in the rotisserie system. I don't know. I thought this was surgery and not cooking. Can a malfunction in the robotic system result in harm to the patient? That's one.
Okay. I mean, in theory, I'm not an expert on the technology. I have seen what happens when a failsafe is tripped, and that is, you know, it prevents harm. The whole system can shut down and the patient will not be harmed. The power can go out in the operating room and the patient will not be harmed. So I know there are many, many failsafes.
So you probably can't answer this question because this would be from one who developed it. But what is the probability that the robotic system would fail during a 1-hour procedure?
Oh, yeah.
No, I don't know.
I don't know the statistics.
I think he might be a lawyer.
It's pretty rare.
I don't know. I want to leave that one alone. All right. And remember, no legal questions here on the program. This is from John in Poughkeepsie. I'm 70 years old. I do a moderate amount of yard work, which often requires lifting or moving logs. Lately, I've developed a little pain and swelling just above to the right of my man gear. Is this the beginning of a hernia? I usually lay down and the pain and swelling go away in about 30 minutes.
It definitely sounds like a classic hernia. sounds like, you know, any number of patient stories that I've heard, you know, men working physical labor, retirees in the garden, all sorts of things. It's hard to say. The best way to know would be to have a doctor, you know, do a physical exam or get a CT scan. But I would certainly keep doing your gardening if that's the thing that's keeping you active.
All right. Well, you know what? I think this is a great time to take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. Oh, we're off to some kind of start here with Dr. Smadar Bogardas. We'll be back. It's Vox Pop Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. Our guest today is Dr. Smadar Bogardas from Troy Surgical Associates. General surgery, robotic surgery today on the program. The number is 800-348-2551, and the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Lisa writes in, I have a hiatal hernia discovered during an endoscopy 2 years ago. 2 years ago, it was 5 centimeters. Last year, it was 3 centimeters. I was told the decrease was due to the position I was on my side. Is there a way to get an accurate measurement? At what size do you recommend surgery?
Yeah, so I can definitely understand how there was a size discrepancy between the endoscopy and some sort of imaging or whatever you had this year. Size really has nothing to do with when I decide to fix a hiatal hernia. It really has to do with how much is it affecting your life. You know, if eating has just become this torture, this, you know, terrible heartburn, feeling like food or even liquids are getting stuck, the minute it encroaches on your quality of life is when I would say it's worth fixing. If it's just something that somebody told you exists, but you never even felt anything from it, I would just leave it alone.
What percentage of the population has hiatal hernias? I know a lot of people with heartburn, a lot of times it's just reflux. Is this a congenital thing, or is this something that develops over time?
It's like any hernia. You know, some people have a predilection towards it, and we don't really know why. It happens over time. You weren't necessarily born with it, but some people do get them early on in life. You know, I've fixed hiatal hernias in anyone from a 20-something-year-old to a 90-something-year-old. So, you know, when people discover it varies dramatically. I don't know exactly what percentage of the population has them, but they're pretty prevalent.
In general, how long does that surgery take if there are no complications or any other funky thing going on?
Usually about an hour and a half, 2 hours.
That's pretty good. That's not too bad at all. And is that an overnight stay to feel better and be discharged?
For me, yes. Some people do it outpatient. You know, you come in that day, you go home the same day. For me, I like to just make sure the patient can drink and is feeling good before they go home.
Dr. Smadar Bogardas joins us today from Troy Surgical Associates. One more email, and then we'll hit the phones for a bit. 800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. Frank writes in, In the movie Prometheus, there is a machine that functions as an automated robotic surgery machine. Are you familiar with the movie?
I'm not.
Nor am I. And okay. My question, Frank says, we'll skip a bit. Is it feasible to think that technology of this type might be available in the future? Automatic robotic surgery.
Like I said, I know it's been developed. I've seen videos of the prototypes at conferences. Whether or not I believe it's close, I would say probably not super close, but, you know, 50, 100 years from now, who knows?
One of the things discussed, and I've done so many shows, I can't remember when we discussed it, but we were talking about robotic surgery that was literally done remotely. So a doc would be in one place, and there was an emergency surgery far off, and he could do the surgery from a different place. Wouldn't that make you uncomfortable?
Well, my understanding is that's part of how robotics kind of took off. It was, you know, U.S. Army and other government bodies that were trying to develop exactly that situation where skilled hands could sit somewhere safe in the U.S. and the patient abroad in a war zone would be operated on. But my understanding is that there still had to be a surgeon on the other end to assist.
Yeah, because what if your Wi-Fi connection went?
Right.
What happens?
Yeah.
That's
good question.
That's scary stuff. All right, Dr. Smadar Bogardas is our guest. Let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551. Pam is in Clifton Park. Hello, Pam. You're on.
Okay, thank you. I just want to know your opinion. I have had intestinal surgery where I had 10 inches of my intestine removed. A couple years after that, I was told I had a bizarre, I don't know how you pronounce it. One surgeon said I needed surgery because I was having symptoms. I got a second opinion, and he didn't feel it was that important to have surgery. I do have symptoms that affect me so severely that I have had to change my lifestyle.
I mean, I would say with anything surgical, that the minute it impinges on your lifestyle, the minute it makes you miserable is the time that I would personally, myself, you know, want to have it addressed.
Mm-hmm. Now, the surgeon who said he didn't think it was that important to have it done has also told me that my symptoms could be from other things. And I'm seeing the surgeon, and I'm seeing another gastroenterologist, and it's been over a year, and it doesn't seem that anybody has answers. Now, they put me on Linzess. Now I can't leave my home in the morning.
Well, Pam, let me just break in for a moment here. Mm-hmm. It will be impossible and unethical for Dr. Bogardus to actually diagnose you over the phone. So this is going to be
right,
general
exactly.
sort of information. All right, go ahead, Doc.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, there's a saying in surgery, you know, you ask five surgeons for their opinion, you're going to get five different opinions. It's impossible for me to know if who's right or if there even is a right answer. It could be that they're both right. But it's certainly your prerogative to get multiple opinions.
All right, Pam.
Right. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. That's our number. Dr. Smadar Bogardus joins us today. 800-348-2551. Steve is in Hinsdale. Hello, Steve.
Hello.
You're on.
Hello.
Hello, you're on.
Yeah, I had a question for you. Would a hospital be able to tell you how many procedures they've performed? Like, say, for example, like a colonoscopy or whatever?
Oh, yeah, sure. The hospital should have that on hand. You just mean like in a year?
Just to see if they know what they're doing, Steve?
Yeah, like would they be able to tell me how many procedures they would have performed?
They should be able to. I don't see why not.
Why do you ask, sir?
Because I've had a particular hospital out here in the Berkshires trying to get information on, you know, how many procedures they performed, like a collapsed lung.
Right.
And I can't get any answers. They say ask the doctor, and I can't confirm.
Yeah. And, well, you know, maybe there is a HIPAA thing involved with that. I don't know the answer to that question, but that's a good one. I'd want to know, hey, have you done this before? Sure, yeah.
Yeah, and I come back with from the patient relations saying they can't provide that information to the public.
Man, maybe that's the case. Doc doesn't know. I don't know, but thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Medical Monday today with Dr. Smadar Bogardus. Let's go to Warwick. Bernie, you're on.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
You're on. Go ahead.
I have an inguinal hernia for probably the last 5 years, and it doesn't bother me at all. I'm also on Eliquis, so I'm always concerned that if it ever gets strangulated, they have to do surgery right away. And I think there's an antidote to Eliquis now. So when you have it, I'm 87 years old, and I've been living with this for 5 years. So there's probably no reason to get surgery on this, is there?
I mean, it's going to be hard to know just talking to you without seeing you. But I would say, you know, if you're really worried about it getting strangulated, that's certainly a risk of inguinal hernias. So that is a reason to get it fixed. But you're right. There is an antidote for Eliquis, a reversal agent, as we call it. So I have had to give patients that before performing an emergency surgery.
So if I ever had that emergency, they could do surgery right away without a bleeding problem.
Right. There would still be some risk, some higher risk of bleeding, but it would not be as severe.
All right, Bernie.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
How does a hernia become strangulated?
So we call, well, any number of things can get strangulated in a hernia, but what we really worry about is bowel, you know, anytime intestines get stuck in a hernia.
Can you unstrangulate it?
You can unstrangulate it, yep. You can reduce it, as we say. You can push it back in either during a surgery or just, you know, when you see the patient in front of you, and that can release any impingement on the bowel, and then people can feel instantly better.
You know, Bernie said he was 87.
Mm-hmm.
You said you'd mentioned you were doing surgery on somebody in his 90s. Is there a limit on certain surgeries, age limit, saying, hey, listen, buddy, you're way beyond the safe zone here?
I mean, I think above a certain age, any surgeon, any doctor would have a conversation with the patient saying, you know, you are higher risk because of your age. There are certainly other medical conditions that come with just being older. But I would say there are a few things, unless they're just elective, cosmetic, that kind of thing, that I would say I won't do it because of your age.
Our guest today is Dr. Smadar Bogardas from Troy Surgical Associates. The number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org, and we'll check the email bag in a little bit. But let's carry on with the phones. We'll go to Newburgh, New York. Looks like it's Geneva. Is that the way you say your name?
Geneva.
Geneva. All right.
Hi.
Yeah, you're on.
Awesome. So I'm curious to hear about if there's an decreased likelihood of adhesions forming between organs operated on with laparoscopic surgery. I'm thinking specifically about endometriosis patients who might be experiencing pain and considering surgery, you know, to remove lesions, but might be advised that there's a risk to create more scarring and more adhesions and more pain. Can you speak to that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. So minimally invasive surgery, you know, laparoscopy or robotics, certainly has a lower risk of adhesions than what we call open surgery. Anytime somebody makes a big incision, I don't myself perform any endometriosis surgeries. That's more of our gynecology colleagues. But anytime you have an abdominal surgery, there's a risk for scar tissue, which is just what adhesions are. You know, even just having your gallbladder out or having a hernia fixed puts you at risk for adhesions. It's just unavoidable, but they're definitely fewer than if you had a big incision surgery done.
Okay, great. And a quick follow-up. Do you take images of the inside of the body as you perform laparoscopic surgery?
Ah, do you record?
I don't record any video or anything like that, but certainly if something is unusual, I take pictures, or if the patient wants to see what their gallbladder looked like or what their appendix looked like, then I'll take pictures. That's definitely a very handy tool.
All right, Geneva, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. Way back when, before this station was in its current incarnation, Albany Med, WAMC comes from Albany Medical College. They would do live surgeries on the radio.
Really?
Now, can you imagine putting a small camera on the robot and just doing an actual class for people? I mean, has that been done?
I don't know about on the robot, but when I was in medical school, we watched some surgeries like that, you know, from a viewing room up above or from somewhere else where they had a mounted camera. It was pretty cool.
Isn't there a Seinfeld about that?
Before my time.
Kramer drops the juju bees in there. Yeah, it's a good one. 800-34 before your time, Seinfeld was oh, no. 800-348-2551. Ouch. Let's go to Jim and Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
Can a ventral hernia be performed under local anesthesia?
Depends how big the ventral hernia is, but that is one thing we didn't really talk about is in robotic surgery, you do have to be under general anesthesia. And so there are patients who age, you know, comorbidities, other things they have going on in their health are not good candidates for general anesthesia. So there are some surgeries, even some hernia surgeries that we do under just local anesthetic.
Jim, you want to follow up?
No, it's okay. Thanks.
All right. Hey, thanks a lot for the call. And just a reminder, when you get on the radio, folks, turn your radio down. Much as I enjoy hearing myself, it's not good radio. So John in Falls Village, you're on.
Okay, let me just do this.
Yeah.
Turn your radio down.
All right. Oh, boy. Here
Turn
we go.
Turn your radio down.
I'll pay you not to do that ever again.
I would love to see a camera on the robotic arm, I mean, of an operation. But... I mean, I love watching them on YouTube. But anyway.
Splendid.
Back to why I'm calling. Bloodless surgery. In other words, there are hospitals that have entire wings devoted to no blood transfusion surgeries. What's your thoughts, doctor?
Yeah, I would say that blood transfusions are fairly rare in the general surgery world. I mean, unless some sort of catastrophic bleeding happens during an emergency surgery, I can't remember the last time an elective robotic case of mine required a blood transfusion. So, I would say it's more common to not have them than it is to have a transfusion.
What do you think about that, John?
And so no robot, but human hands performing. How about no blood transfusion then, no matter what?
Yep. I would say same thing. Even if I'm just doing something laparoscopically, you know, unless the whole reason I was operating was because of bleeding, then it's pretty rare to need a blood transfusion.
Okay. Hey, John, thank you for the call. And just would like you to just say on the record that you will never sing again on this program. No?
Thanks, Ray.
All right. Oh, he didn't see it. 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday. Dr. Smadar Bagardis joins us from Troy Surgical Associates. A couple emails here, and then we'll hit a break and go back to the phones. Peter writes, does any of this robotics discussion relate to any eye surgery, including but not limited to cataract surgery? Does any of this robotics discussion relate to biopsies and cancer surgery? So a couple questions there.
Eye surgery, I have no idea because I'm not an ophthalmologist, but I know that there are robots for orthopedic surgery. There are robots for urologic surgery. So, you know, not all the same necessarily company of robotics, but certainly there are robots being developed for everything.
When we, the layman, think of robots, we're thinking of, you know, Lost in Space and a big, huge walking, talking thing. Exactly what are we talking about when we say robotic surgery? What's the hardware look like?
Yeah, so in general surgery, the most common product, you're basically talking about an arm that sits over the top of the patient once they're asleep that has some instruments attached to it, and then the surgeon themselves sits in a corner of the room in a console with their head inside with multiple screens that give us this 3D, 360-degree view. So it's a lot more like open surgery than it was like laparoscopy.
And do you have a joystick or do you put your hand inside a glove? I mean, how do you do this and ensure control that you are controlling it?
We have a combination of foot pedals and then two, I guess they're kind of like sleeves or like gloves that you put your fingers in.
And this is more precise than doing it by hand, the old school way?
In some cases, definitely, because those instruments are much smaller than my fingers.
Ah, okay, let's take a break here. 800-348-2551. Dr. Smadar Bagardis joins us, and we'll be back. Vox Pop Medical Monday. Ray Graff here, joined today by Dr. Smadar Bagardis from Troy Surgical Associates, and I'm sure she'll never be back on the program after this one. 800-348-2551. You're doing fine. We're all just a little off today, and maybe that's just the biorhythms or whatever. You can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. That's what John did. John is in the 845, and he writes, my mother-in-law is 93 with a large hiatal hernia. She has AFib and edema in her legs, but she still cooks and does laundry, etc. She's careful about eating certain things, but doesn't think that has to do with this. Is a 93-year-old, we talked about this, is a 93-year-old a candidate for surgery? What would the recovery be like? Aha.
So, you know, coincidentally, I suppose, in the last 2 months, I've operated on two 90-plus-year-olds for hiatal hernias. Both situations were in the semi-emergent, scenario, but what I would say is there are lesser procedures that are available for her.
What do you mean semi-emergent? Explain.
So if hiatal hernia has become big enough, if enough of your stomach is in your chest, then it can actually twist. It can flip on itself. and then your stomach can't pass any of the food you're drinking. So then that becomes more of an emergency because that person can't eat or drink.
Right.
And these things sometimes untwist themselves, but very rarely. And so in those two situations, I had to offer them a surgery. And what I did was not the two-hour hiatal hernia surgery that we talked about earlier, but rather a 30-minute sort of temporizing, more less invasive surgery, I should say.
You know, the number here, by the way, is 800-348-2551. It's general surgery today and robotic surgery with Dr. Smadar Bogardis. In a non-emergency situation where you have maybe you're doing a colectomy or something, what imaging protocols are you using before you cut, before you even start the procedure? How much imaging and of what variety are you using?
I would say 90% of the time we have a CT scan.
Okay, and what does that stand for?
Oh, now you got me.
All right, fair enough.
But it's but there are situations where we only have an ultrasound, especially with gallbladder surgery. And there are hernias that we can just feel with our hands, so we don't need any sort of imaging.
I mean, but so there's no standard. You don't say, well, listen, at the very least, we're going to need x-rays. You know what you're going to get when you open up most of the time.
Most of the time. But I will say, you know, there are definitely surprises. CT scans can be wrong. CT scans, for instance, can't see any scar tissue. So if someone's had a previous surgery, we have to assume that there will be some element of scar tissue. And sometimes we're wrong, and that's great. And sometimes we're right, and it adds a lot of time to the surgery.
What's the toughest, in general, type of surgery that you would have to do on a regular basis? The most, not necessarily toughest, but the most detailed and rigorous and time-consuming?
Yeah, I mean, the surgeries that keep me up at night, for instance, are the colon surgeries.
Why?
Because you have to, most of the time, your goal is to reconnect someone, you know, not to take out a piece of their colon and end up giving them an ostomy or a bag because, you know, most people don't want that. And so you worry about how healthy the two pieces of colon that you put together are. You worry about how well you sealed the connection.
And how do you seal the connection?
A combination of stapling and sewing.
Really? Mm-hmm. And it'll seal up on its own. It won't leak on it. Just using staples and sewing.
Yep.
Buddy of mine long ago had a burst appendix.
Mm-hmm.
And his surgery took hours and hours and hours because the appendix had wrapped around the colon. And the surgeon was sweating and just in bad, just terrible. And it came out fine. But it was a really tough surgery. Is the colon very fragile?
It can be. It is not one of our more forgiving organs. You know, like the stomach, for instance, has blood supply from four different arteries. So you can do a lot of damage to the stomach and it will recover. The colon usually relies on one, maybe two arteries, depending on which segment it is. So it does tend to be on the more fragile side.
And you mentioned an ostomy. If you so much as prick a little hole in it, then you can't repair that?
Sometimes you can. Yeah, certainly if you're doing something else, you're taking out somebody's gallbladder and you happen to accidentally injure something, then just putting a stitch in it is doable. But if your whole reason for being there was taking out a piece of the colon, those are higher stakes.
In abdominal surgery in general, and by the way, we're joined by Dr. Smadar Bogardis today. It's general and robotic surgery. If you have a question, 800-348-2551 is the number. In general, in abdominal surgery, can you use lasers at all? Do you?
I don't in my practice. I think in urology they do, but I would not swear to that.
Okay, fair enough. This email from Jeff in Troy. Why are not patients offered being fully sedated when having a prostate biopsy performed? Jeff in Troy.
I would unfortunately have to defer to my urology colleagues.
All right,
don't know about that one.
Number here is 800-348-2551. If you have a question about robotic surgery or general surgery for Dr. Smadar Bogardis, we'll go to Ellenville now. And I think Mike might be off topic here. Mike, hello. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
I love the show.
Okay.
I'm taking Ozempic. I just started a little while ago.
Yeah.
And I'm burping a lot.
Yeah.
And my wife says, "Oh, your gallbladder, you're going to need your gallbladder out." Is she wrong about that?
I would say, you know, belching is not necessarily a sign of anything being wrong with your gallbladder.
Thank God for that.
Ozempic does have some side effects, but nothing is a slam dunk. You know, if you start getting pain up under your right rib cage after you eat, that would be a sign that I would say that you should go get your gallbladder checked out.
Oh, okay. I don't have any of that. The Ozempic is actually working pretty well because I'm not hungry very often.
Oh, good,
between
man.
Between meals, and it seems to be working.
Splendid. Well, it's slightly different show, but thank you, Mike. Appreciate the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's surgery and robotic surgery today with Dr. Smadar Bogardis. 800-348-2551. Chris is in Brantford, Connecticut. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Ray. How are you? Hello, doctor. Thank you both for taking my call. I have a 25-year-old who had a fairly miserable teenage life with ulcerative colitis. He had his large intestine removed, and there's still a portion of it at the end, and it still gives him a lot of problems. And the problem we're having is finding a surgeon that can connect the small intestine, the end result, as it were. And they're supposedly there's like three in the country. And I'm wondering if I know you were just talking about this and how touchy it is. Are there any more surgeons? Is it something that's happening? Can robotics do it? You know, all that kind of razzmatazz.
Yeah, I would say on the whole, what you need is a colorectal surgeon. What it sounds like is he probably had all of the abdominal portion of his colon removed and maybe just still has a bit of his rectum. So, you know, you're looking for a surgeon who's going to remove the rest of his rectum and form likely what's called a J pouch or an S pouch out of small intestine.
Okay.
And the experts in that are colorectal surgeons. But I would say they're not too far and few between, you know, definitely more than three surgeons in the whole country.
Wow.
Oh, that's great.
All right. Well, Chris, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551. If you have a question for Dr. Smadar Bogardis from Troy Surgical Associates, you can email voxpop@wamc.org. Let's talk about the gallbladder for a little bit. I find it steeped in mystery. Why do they go bad in some people, and some people they're just fine?
Boy, I think if I had the answer to that, I'd be a millionaire. But
well, you're a surgeon. You're going to be a millionaire soon enough, right? As soon as you get the college loans paid off.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Okay.
But, you know, what I tell people is gallstones, which are usually the issue with gallbladders, tons of us have them. Plenty of us die with the gallstones and never even knew we had them to begin with. Why some people have gallbladder attacks, end up with emergency gallbladder surgery, is really quite unpredictable. But once you know you have gallstones, if they're giving you trouble, then that's the time to have them removed.
Why do gallstones happen?
So the gallbladder is like a little storage balloon for bile, which is a liquid that your liver makes that helps you with digestion. But if that bile, if that liquid sits there for too long, it clumps up and becomes like sand. And that sand can get even clumpier and become stones.
And when someone has a gallbladder attack, what is actually going on?
So usually it's the gallbladder trying to give you all that extra bile, trying to squeeze, but it's like squeezing your hand around a bunch of rocks. You know, it just hurts.
Now, when you say squeeze, are there muscles around the gallbladder that actually physically squeeze it?
Yeah, the gallbladder has a little sphincter, essentially, and so that sphincter relaxes, and the gallbladder tries to push all that extra liquid that it's storing for us through.
How many of those do you do? How many emergency gallbladder removals do you do a year?
Oh, in a year, like, many.
Really? Now, is this a diet thing in Europe, or maybe what they talk about the Mediterranean diet?
Yeah.
Are there fewer instances of gallbladder attacks?
I don't know the numbers, but my understanding is yes, the U.S. has gallbladder issues a lot more than the rest of the world.
Is it salt? Is it booze? What are we?
It's fat. It's oil in our diet. You know, we eat a lot more processed foods. We eat a lot less fiber in our diet. All those things combine into issues like gallbladder disease or diverticulitis. There are a lot of things that are more common here in the U.S.
If you remove a gallbladder, and I know a lot of people have had their gallbladders removed, And they don't seem to have a lot of special medical instructions for the rest of their lives.
No, I
How important is it then?
I mean, it's the same question about the appendix. Well, you know, yeah. We can live without our appendix just fine, so why do we still have it? And again, if I knew that answer, you know, I'd be rich. But the gallbladder, you can definitely live without. I tell patients they can eat whatever they want. Once it's gone, they're, you know, not going to have those same pain attacks. And so
Amazing.
Why not?
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Now I'm actually looking forward to a gallbladder attack because I know. Let's go to Barry in Kerhonkson. Barry, you're on. Hey, Barry. How you doing, buddy?
Yes.
You go ahead.
Yeah. I was just curious. In diverticulitis, is there such a tool that actually vacuums the pockets?
Not one that I know of. You know, you can go in with a colonoscopy and try to clean out the pockets, but usually once someone has it, you know, we're talking about tens to twenties of those little pockets, and they're minuscule. They're a couple millimeters each, so that would be quite tedious, and I think they would fill right back in pretty quickly.
With what?
With stool.
Oh, splendid. Barry, you got a follow-up?
No, that's it. I just thought there might be such a tool that actually vacuums the pockets out.
Maybe you got an idea there. All right, Barry. You know, that could be an invention. You don't do that surgery, right?
Diverticulitis surgery? That's part of taking somebody's colon out, yep.
Yeah, and so a buddy of mine, a relative of mine, had an attack one time. Only once in his entire life did he have an attack of diverticulitis. Why would it be a problem one day and not the next day?
Again, these are one of those mysteries of the human body kind of questions. But, you know, some people get diverticulitis and it's really mild. They just need some antibiotics. They stay home. They keep going to work. And some people end up so sick they're in the ICU. And,
Jeepers.
You know, who gets which type of attack, which severity, very hard to predict.
All right, let's go back to our phone lines with Dr. Smadar Bogardas, 800-348-2551. Barbara's in Kingston. Hello, Barbara. You're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I had a question about diverticulitis. My gastroenterologist had mentioned surgery, and my surgeon had said that was something that I really didn't want to do. So what are your thoughts about that?
I mean, without knowing too much about your medical history, there are certainly risks and benefits to having surgery for diverticulitis. As we've been discussing, colon surgery is a major abdominal surgery, even if you have it through small incisions, like with robotics. So, you know, depending on how well you are in the rest of your life, that surgeon may have been thinking that what are the odds of you having another attack? But these things are...
I've had three. He told me after I had the first, he said that I would have probably more. So I've had three attacks. And I do have a compromised immune system, and I'm on the fence. You know, everybody says, well, you can eat whatever you want. Other people say, you know, don't eat things with seeds or popcorn. And
I thought that myth was sort of dispelled.
Yeah, in medical literature, those recommendations are pretty antiquated. At least I, in my practice, don't no longer recommend avoiding seeds or roughage, all those greens.
I wonder, how did that come to be? How did that sort of... wives' tale sort of happen?
I don't know exactly. I would assume there was a study on it someday, you know, years and years ago, and then it became canon for a while.
Okay. Barbara, thanks a lot. Let's go to Ellenville. Anitra, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay. I am calling because I have a trigger finger, my ring finger on my left hand, and it goes fairly frequently and is sort of uncomfortable. And I have this idea that if I just stopped eating sugar altogether, that it might clear up. And am I just fooling myself? And when do you know when it's indicated, trigger finger surgery?
That is a great question for an orthopedic surgeon.
Right.
Somebody
we're
like
going to have on
doctor.
The show soon. Actually, I think there's an orthopedic surgeon coming on within the next several weeks. So you could definitely do the trigger finger thing
then.
All right. Thank you. 800-348-2551. In the waning moments here with Dr. Smadar Bogardus, who will probably run away screaming and never come back. Let's go to New Paltz. Antonio, you're on.
Hey, thank you. First-time caller.
Welcome.
Definitely going to look forward to that orthopedic surgeon.
Okay.
A quick question. The inflammation and the diverticuli, I was wondering if allergy can cause this inflammation and things like that, and even slight allergies. And if a person eats a certain type of food and they notice it spikes, is it just best that they themselves just figure it out, that stay away from that stuff? Or
I would always advocate that you listen to your own body. I mean, if there is a food that causes you to be uncomfortable every single time you eat it, then, you know, better to avoid it than not. However, I don't believe there's any literature showing that allergies or particular food types cause diverticulitis flares. I think for the most part, it's, you know, constipation, lack of fiber in your diet, combined with some element of bad luck.
Ah, okay. Okay. Fiber. Okay. Thank you.
Hey, thanks a lot for the call. We only have a minute or so. We have enough time for maybe one more. 800-348-2551. Bob, let's push this last caller through real quickly here if we can, and we'll try to get that person on the air. Have you enjoyed the show?
Definitely.
Yeah, it's been all right. All right, let's go to the line here. Who's on the line with us? Hello? No?
Hello?
You're on. You only have about 30 seconds, though. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm having a CT scan this coming Wednesday of my abdomen because I'm having terrible pain and loose stools. It's been going on for about 2 months. I just wanted to know what the doctor would think is going on with me.
Tough to diagnose on the phone, eh? But
I would say probably you'll have an answer after that CT scan. And if you don't, then, then a colonoscopy might be in your future.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. We'll have to leave it there. All right, Dr. Bogardus, anything that we didn't cover here? It has to be a lot, right?
I mean, general surgery is a very wide, very breadthy specialty, I would say. You know, make sure you're seeing your dermatologist to get skin checks. Skin cancer is also...
You do skin surgery, too?
Mm-hmm. Skin cancer is definitely one of the general surgery surgeries.
Yeah. Well, I think we've exhausted this topic. You've done very, very well, and thank you for being here. Troy Surgical Associates, part of St. Peter's Health Partners, right? Okay, and you can find that online. We have a link on our website. Thanks for being on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Support comes from Southwestern Vermont Medical Center, working to meet healthcare needs from primary to specialty care for communities in southern Vermont, eastern New York, and northern Massachusetts. SVMC.org for more information. Thanks again to Dr. Smadar Bogardus of Troy Surgical Associates for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls. Most of them were right on point. Thanks to our engineer, Mike Bowen. Well done, sir. Boy, putting in the double duty, are you, this last couple weeks. Good for you, man. Bob Rathman, back from vacation, looking rested, and screened the calls today. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's a make-good edition of a show we lost to the Fun Drive. Now, the Fun Drive was brief. All right, it was only 3.5 days, but we did miss the Bird Show with Rich Guthrie and Julie Hart. So we're going to do it tomorrow at 2. If you've seen a bird and you want to know something, call us.